As we've been sitting over the last several weeks with these stories from the book of Job, we've been skirting around time and again the fine line between simply the words of suffering and those of frustration and anger and lament. And if you read through these 42 chapters, you'll see time and again this back and forth of, yes, but this is how I feel, and this is where I am. As well as the famous friends of Job coming along and saying, oh, but, maybe you shouldn't feel that or do that or say that. Surely there's some rational explanation for why you've ended up where you are. But time and again, Job keeps coming back to, no, here I am, and here is how I feel. And this is one of those replies to those rational thoughts of, surely you did something to anger God. This comes in the middle of the text, chapter 23. I'll read verses 1 through 9 and 16 and 17. Job said in reply, today again my complaint is bitter. My strength is spent on account of my groaning. Would that I would know how to reach him, how to get to his dwelling place. I would set out my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn what answers Yahweh has for me and how he would reply for me. Would he contend with me overbearingly? Surely he would not accuse me. There, the upright would be cleared by Yahweh, and I would escape forever from my judge. But if I go east, he is not there. West, I will still do not perceive him. North, since he is concealed, I do not behold him. South, he is hidden. I cannot see him. God has made me faint-hearted. Shaddai has terrified me. Yet I am not cut out by the darkness. He has concealed the thick gloom from me. The line between good and bad is exceedingly fine. As one that we tread often without a great deal of thought, spare that sort of notion, like if you happen to have a bit of a slip on the roof and just sort of say, huh, that would have ruined my day. And by and large, that's how we live our lives, is sort of walking this line between good and bad. I remember one time where that line went the other way for us. My brother and I had the spur-of-the-moment idea to go on a backpacking trip. And we just sort of threw the ordinary ho-hum elements of planning and forethought to the wind and embrace the idea of, yes, we need to jump in the car, go down there, find a place to be and camp, and we'll have a grand old time. And so we had hiked and we had our secondhand gear that, well, we had never actually tested. Surely it would be good enough. And we went with all the energy and bravado that a college sophomore and a high school junior could manage. which was all indeed great fun until you got there and it was basically, you know, this weather. 40 degrees and raining the whole time. In only the way that it can rain in the east of, it just doesn't stop. And muddling through our unplanned route meant that where we wanted to stop wasn't quite where it was, and our meal of canned stew and what have you overlooked the minor necessity of a can opener. And those things on the multi-tools are, I'm utterly convinced, are solely there just to infuriate you, because they don't actually work. And of course, our untested gear leaked like a sieve. And it went from a fairly good lark to a bit of a death march in about an hour and a half. Never was a night spent sleeping in a 1980s Honda CRX was more welcome. It wasn't much for morale, it was at least dry. Things had gone the way that we didn't expect to, and there was plenty to carry and plenty to be there. And what we thought was just going to be fun and games and a good memory, well, it's a memory all right. And I have to say that my brother specializes in this sort of experience. He's great fun at a party because he can tell all sorts of stories of falling and breaking limbs and everything else because that's just his thing. And on it goes. But sometimes those memories of when things went a different way are not as funny and not nearly as entertaining. Sometimes these can be the things of bitterness that can haunt our lives. Bitterness occurs when the sweet turns to sour, when the delightful becomes distasteful and pleasure descends into pain. And as such, we have all, to one degree or another, experienced bitter experiences in life. Things have not ended as we would have wished. We have lost. We are losing. While I am not for a second comparing a couple days' discomfortable camping to the real pains and realities of life and living, I offer it solely as an analogy. What you plan well and what you know well and then what happens can be two very different things. And the consequences are formidable. What we mean to be the pleasures of life do not always turn this way. And sometimes it's precisely because the things of the life hold such value to us that we love so deeply that losing can be so painful. And from week to week, as I consider to whom I speak, I'm often given to imagining your relative positions, both known and purely out of my imagination, and considering how certain words might land on particular ears. And while I cannot imagine who or what or why, I always have to come with the question of, I wonder who in church is sad. I wonder who in the pews is carrying grief. I wonder who out there is there. And again, while I don't necessarily know who or what or where, I know that somebody is. Brian Walden won somebody. Because it's there and real. And it has to be said that whatever you bring on whatever Sunday, happy, glad, sad, contemplative, it's okay. And I'll even go a step further. You especially have permission to be sad. It's good and holy and okay. And what's more, it's okay to be sad with God. Because that's important. But we don't often say so. And we don't often go there. I'll come back to this in just a bit. Sitting with Job, as we are, it's important to connect how important elements of the text make it unique. First, we should know that while the book has 42 chapters, as I've said, we've long since left behind the action of the story. The stuff that happens to Job and his family, the stuff that is there, happens in the first two chapters. Everything else in the whole rest of the story is people talking about what already happened and reviewing what was there and debating fiercely the stuff of, well, so why? And now what? The story here is not about the actions that happened to Job, but what happens in Job out of those circumstances. And that makes it a bit of an oddity. Because most of the stories that we have in the Bible are those of action and deliverance. Think of the Gospel of Mark, which is the lectionary gospel right now. It's always going back and saying, well, then immediately Jesus did this, and immediately this happened, and Jesus spoke and rubbed mud on the eyes. Immediately everything changed. We may well imagine the context of what happened to those who were healed, or what happened along the way, or how they might struggle, but by and large, the story that we have is of them simply being healed, and that's that. But here, in Job and with Job, we have this whole development of what's going on in the process. When we first began sitting with these stories in the action, we had this bit of action between Job and his wife. And remember how she expressed the pain and sorrow of the situation, only to have Job snap at her and call her to only be faithful in a time of difficulty. We never hear from her again, spare the fact that the ideas that she presents keep coming back as echoes time and again as Job develops in his process. Say what he will and give all attention to his patience, of course, he is not immune to the despair of the situation, but has tried time and again in his resolve to endure and to carry on in a faithful way in how he considers what he's dealing with. And he has to deal with both the inability to change in circumstances or to be relieved from it, but also to be compounded by the well-meant but ill-placed musings of friends who come alongside and seem far more inclined to diagnose the problem than to simply be with one who suffers. It's far easier to offer words of encouragement in the face of the disaster than to live faithfully through it. And we all say words to comfort that may or may not feel like an additional burden than a relief. Not because we were mean, not because we set out to do harm, but simply because sometimes that's all we had to say. It's all that we can think of. And we don't like the rawness of lament because it feels so far outside of the normal range of rational emotions. We don't allow sadness in our midst, especially in church, because it's too closely akin to the sense of failing the primary Christian duty as we've been taught, to simply be happy and upbeat and to find our way through. We might allow the narrow corridor of a time frame for grief after a death or a loss or something like that, but by and large, we don't really go there. Because it's simply not how we express our vision of the world. Writer Ron Evans writes in Considering the Aging Process, reflects how sometimes the sadness that comes with it doesn't have much of a place. He writes, "In a world where old age becomes golden years, where every problem can be fixed and every ailment cured, let the preacher say that you have permission to be sad." Our culture, occupied as it is with the necessity and demands of bringing our life and our best lives now, has very little bandwidth to deal with the expression of sad. And we need to acknowledge that sadness is not of itself bad, nor in it or by itself a diagnosable cure for concern. Yes, depression is real and it must be addressed, but that is a sadness and a reality of a far different sort. Sadness of simply carrying the weight of life is a part of life where the realities of life and the disappointments that can accompany living can simply be something that we carry. The sadness of our souls can get a chance to speak out of the frustration, the loss, death, inadequacy, moral failures, or simply the circumstances of our lives that are very much real, can feel very bitter, and be ultimately unalterable. And most of the time we do what we do simply because the only thing left us is to simply accept what is. And sadness can be the price that we pay for that. And when we fail to listen to the voice of sadness, when we fail to know its import, our health and our souls suffer alongside. By now, I should have you good and thoroughly depressed. And that's okay. We can do this for a Sunday. But I don't want to leave you there either. Too often we choose what is easy far above what is right. It's not easy to carry our sadness. It's harder still to hold it in any sort of public fashion. There's a reason why we begin the work of grief with denial. It's the most immediate and accessible response that we have to the realities of life to simply say, nope, it's not happening, it's not there. But when we progress beyond that, we end up in Job's territory. And I think we can take a lesson from him. We can, like him, find ourselves searching the points of the compass to find the face of God, any face that might be able to address what we're going through and the questions of our lives. And that is where Job introduces the voice of lament. Job is negotiating with God by way of lament. He starts out wanting to escape and expresses a desire to simply see it all end, and a desire that was further supported by his friend's hope to say, well, it'll just all go away. But in the end, escape isn't good enough for Job. It is impossible, as he notes, that in death to find reality. But also, even more so, he gets to the point of saying, no, I don't want to go away. I want to have these questions answered. I want to see my vindication and my righteousness here and now. I want God to come and speak to me. And it is in this that Job finds hope in God for vindication, ironically, from a God that he sees and says is increasingly unjust, but would be brought to bear and would see even the state of his righteousness and find him blameless. It seems far off, but this is what Job is spending his time in lamenting to do. And as such, it brings us to one of the cores of lament and why it is important. Lament is an act of hope that engages the Holy One in the fullness of our despair. Lament trusts God with the feelings that we don't want to have. Lament honors God, who does the hard things and has created us in God's image. And lament moves us from simply the bitterness of wanting to escape to the hope of believing that there is something else, and redemption and justice and healing are possible. As such, it trusts that there is someone, anyone out there that is ready to hear, even if that someone is not easily at home, hand. We have to lament, which is not as it should be, that which is not as it should be, and to acknowledge the places where our best laid plans or wildest dreams, as the case may be, do not always come to fruition, and that can disappoint us. In the long litanies of the ills of the world, we can get so bruised by the recitation of simply Christ have mercy that we can forget that that very simple prayer is one of the most powerful that we have at our disposal. We don't need to pray and give God directions of how to fix it or how to heal it, although we can if we want. Sometimes all we want is simply to, Christ, hear me. Christ, see this. Christ, move in this. Christ, acknowledge this. And that can be enough. Because it's far more deadly to simply say, yeah, there's nothing there, and there never will be. It's silence that kills the soul. But lament and struggle and arm wrestling, at least there's still something for the soul to do and to reach for. Job reaches the point that he can say what needs to be said. imploring the Almighty to act, even while he's still bringing his case before God. Job's lament is a true lament, not just a venting into the abyss or a griping of the fruitlessness that we can feel just to feel better. But it's a lament that can lead ultimately to redemption. So what do you think? Dare we lament? Dare we lament the stuff that of our lives that we wish could be different? Dare we grieve a world that is broken and seems well beyond facing? Holding it out to God, speaking of the world and the sadness and realities, and calling on God to act. Is this something that we can do for ourselves? Is this something that we can do as a church? One of the perils of material comfort is that we're so used to comfort, and we're so used to the relative power that our abilities give us, that we begin to expect that the world will always conform to our wishes and our expectations. And when it fails to do so, as it inevitably will, we are loath to lament because it seems far too needy and out there for the likes of us. But when we can find the courage to name what is, especially when we name the stuff that we wish were different, we can begin to rehearse for the far bigger things between God and us. The speaking of sadness, the soulless of God simply not always answering explicitly as we would have God answer, but simply being there. We lament because we must. And if we can't lament, how are we going to confront any other oppression in the world? Either we can't say, yeah, this is bad, without necessarily having the fits or the answer or the prescription. And it's just one more way of embracing the status quo, saying, well, there's nothing there. We can't change it anyways. We don't know what to do. My friends, wherever you find yourself, know that God, though hidden, remains present. And however you experience lament and sadness, know that you were embraced and loved and supported fully and completely by the hand of God. Amen.